From New York City, the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, this is Democracy Now! Nationwide uprising since the 1960s. Protesters shut down cities across the United States following the police killing of George Floyd, an African-American man in Minneapolis. At least 40 cities have imposed curfews. The National Guard's been deployed across the country. Thousands of people have been arrested as police violently crack down on the protests calling for racial justice. Police cars have been set on fire in cities from New York to Los Angeles.
I woke up wanting to see the world burn down yesterday because I'm tired of seeing black men die. He casually put his knee on a human being's neck for 9 minutes as he died like a zebra in the clutch of a lion's jaw. And we watch it like murder porn over and over again. So that's why children are burning to the ground. They don't know what else to do.
The protests come as the nation faces its biggest public health crisis in decades and the highest level of unemployment since the Great Depression. We'll speak with Professors Cornel West and Kianga Yamata-Taylor, as well as attorney Bakari Sellers, author of the new memoir, My Vanishing Country. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Protests erupted across the United States as people continue to take to the streets over the weekend following the killing of 46-year-old George Floyd by white police officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis. Curfews have been enacted in at least 40 cities, including Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Chicago, and Seattle. The National Guard was called in to several states as protests mounted. Protesters in Minneapolis are calling for the arrest of all four officers involved in Floyd's death. Derek Chauvin was charged Friday with third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. The three other officers who were fired along with Chauvin have not been charged, even as new video appears to show two of them also kneeling on George Floyd's body as he laid on the pavement and Chauvin had his knee on his neck. On Saturday, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz said he'd fully mobilize the National Guard for the first time in his state's history, adding another 1,000 soldiers to the 700 he'd already ordered into the streets of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Throughout the weekend, crowds of protesters were met with wave after wave of tear gas, rubber-coated bullets, and stun grenades. This is Minneapolis community leader, business owner Marquise Armstrong, speaking at a protest Saturday.
They continued to allow the abuses to happen to the community. And so this is an uprising. We are not condoning the violence that's happening, the looting, the rioting. We understand it, though. We want this city to not burn. But it seems like that's what it has to take in order for them to finally start listening to us. Like I said, 6 years we've been saying to them, introducing policy changes, sitting across the table from them, from the mayor, from the police and the governor, the city council members. We've been talking to them. We've been sitting with them. We've been urging them. We've been challenging them. We've been pushing them. And they ain't listening. We're tired of living.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz said Saturday he'd asked Pentagon Chief Mark Esper and the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to help gather signal intelligence on protesters. On Friday, publicly available flight data showed Customs and Borders Protection had diverted one of its Predator drones to circle 20,000 feet above Minneapolis as protesters gathered in the streets below. The drone's normally used to patrol the U.S.-Canadian border far to the north of the Twin Cities. A viral video posted online Saturday night shows a phalanx of officers in riot gear following an armored personnel carrier down a residential street in Minneapolis's Whittier neighborhood after an 8 p.m. curfew went into effect. Officers repeatedly shout at residents to remain inside their homes before firing crowd control rounds on a group of residents peacefully filming from their front porch. In another harrowing moment, a truck driver barreled a tanker truck into a crowd of peaceful protesters who were occupying a Minneapolis interstate on Saturday afternoon. A crowd of thousands of people parted, with many diving to avoid the wheels of the massive truck. The driver slowed the vehicle as protesters surrounded him, then pulled him from the cab and roughed him up. Police moved in and arrested the driver, 35-year-old Bogdan Vichirko, who was booked on assault charges. Police officers in Louisville, Kentucky, said law enforcement fatally shot a protester early this morning while the police force and the National Guard were attempting to break up a crowd. Protesters in Louisville have been demanding justice for Breonna Taylor, the 26-year-old aspiring nurse who was shot to death by police inside her own apartment in March. Here in New York City, multiple protests unfolded over the weekend as thousands of people poured into the previously deserted neighborhoods due to the coronavirus lockdown. In Times Square Sunday, hundreds took a knee in silence to remember George Floyd. Protesters shut down traffic on the Manhattan Bridge Sunday. Meanwhile, in Brooklyn, a shocking video shows two police SUVs ramming into a crowd of protesters. Mayor Bill de Blasio defended the actions of the officers, placing blame on the protesters. NYPD said they've made nearly 800 arrests since the protests started. One of those arrested was Chera de Blasio, Mayor de Blasio's 25-year-old daughter. Chera, who is African-American, was arrested at a protest in downtown Manhattan. She's since been released. In New York and Minneapolis, protesters cheered for unionized bus drivers who refused to transport arrested protesters to jails. In Columbus, Ohio, three government officials were pepper sprayed by police Saturday morning. City Council President Shannon Harden, Franklin County Commissioner Kevin Boyce, and Congressmember Joyce Beatty, all of them Black Congressmember Beatty, had stepped in to de-escalate a scuffle. In Seattle, Washington, disturbing images of a child who was apparently maced by a police officer has provoked outrage. Social media photos and videos show the 9-year-old girl in obvious distress as adults, crying as adults around her pour milk on her face to help alleviate the pain. In Washington, D.C., Secret Service confronted protesters outside the White House. Officials say President Trump took refuge in the White House bunker for an hour Friday night as hundreds protested outside. This is a protester speaking Saturday in front of the Capitol building.
What job you have, where you live, how many degrees you have. If your skin is black, you're automatically a threat.
In Sacramento, California, 19-year-old's in hospital with broken jaw after he was shot in the face with a rubber bullet while standing in place peacefully protesting. Deshaun McHolder had just graduated from high school days before he attended the protest. Elsewhere in California, Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency Saturday night for all of Los Angeles County. In Atlanta, Georgia, two police officers have been fired for using excessive force after they tased two young Black students, one from Morehouse, the other from Spelman, who were in their car. They said they were allegedly violating the city's curfew Saturday night.
Come to me. Come to me right now. This woman just got tased. Come to me right now.
One officer smashed the window of the car they were in as they were tased. Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms condemned the attack. She also warned Atlanta residents this weekend of the additional health risks of protesting during the coronavirus pandemic.
We're out protesting last night, you probably need to go get a COVID test this week. Yes. Because there's still a pandemic in America that's killing black and brown people at higher numbers.
Protests also took place around the world, including Britain, Germany, and New Zealand. In Spain, solidarity protests were limited to 10 people due to coronavirus restrictions. Numerous reporters have been targeted as they covered protests around the country. Freelance photographer Linda Tirado was told by doctors she'd be permanently blind in her left eye after being shot by Minneapolis police. Also in Minneapolis, an officer threw Vice News reporter Michael Anthony Adams face first into the pavement of a gas station Saturday night as he shouted "press" and displayed his media ID above his head. Moments later, another officer casually blasted Adams directly in the face with pepper spray as he lay prone on the pavement. In Louisville, Kentucky, a local reporter and photographer were hit by pepper balls while broadcasting live. The officer appeared to be aiming directly at Caitlin Rust and photojournalist James Dobson.
Are you okay?
I'm getting shot! I'm getting...
Katie, are you okay?
Rubber bullets, rubber bullets. It's okay. It's those pepper bullets. It's those pepper bullets.
Who are they aiming that at?
Now he's shooting at the photographer.
At us. Like, directly at us. Directly
at us. Why are they doing that?
He's shooting at our crew.
In Los Angeles, public radio reporter Adolfo Guzman Lopez tweeted a gruesome photo of a wound he received after a police officer shot him in the throat with a rubber-coated bullet. The Committee to Protect Journalists has issued a safety advisory for reporters covering the protests, which includes avoiding working alone and wearing protective gear, including body armor. The group also warns of the increased risk of contracting the coronavirus, given the difficulty of maintaining social distancing. Authorities in Minnesota are now investigating the role of white supremacists may be playing in the protests. The Twin Cities TV station KARE reports at least one person arrested in Minneapolis had shown clear support for white supremacy on their Facebook page. Meanwhile, President Trump and Attorney General William Barr have threatened to take action against anti-fascist activists. On Sunday, Trump tweeted he would label Antifa as a terrorist organization, even though he doesn't have the legal authority to do so. This comes as Trump is facing widespread criticism for inflaming tensions in the country. On Friday, Trump tweeted, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts," quoting a phrase used by many segregationists in the 1960s. He also threatened protesters outside the White House with, quote, "vicious dogs" and, quote, "ominous weapons." At rallies across the country, some protesters also held signs calling for justice for Tony McDade, a black transgender man shot and killed by Florida police last week. Police say they shot the 38-year-old after they suspected he was involved in a stabbing and alleged he had a gun. Hours before his killing, Tony McDade posted a video on social media saying he'd been attacked by a group of men and was targeted because he was a black trans man. McDade's was at least the third fatal police shooting in Tallahassee in 2 months. The number of people infected by the coronavirus across the globe has topped 6 million. Nearly 375,000 people have died, but many believe that's an extreme undercount, while the world is facing one of its biggest public health crises in decades. President Trump has announced the United States is terminating its relationship with the World Health Organization. Historically, the United States has been the largest contributor to the WHO. This comes as coronavirus cases continue to surge in Latin America, now considered the epicenter of the pandemic. The region accounts for around 40% of new daily coronavirus deaths. Brazil, which has the highest number of infections in Latin America and the second highest in the world after the United States, has become the fourth highest nation in COVID-19 deaths. Peru and Mexico saw record numbers of cases in recent days, even as Mexico moves to reopen its economy. Chile now has over 100,000 confirmed coronavirus cases. Meanwhile, Central American nations are bracing for more devastation brought by tropical tropical storm Amanda. At least 14 people have been killed in El Salvador as floods and torrential downpours batter the region. Here in the United States, a new study shows the U.S. coronavirus death toll likely surpassed 100,000 weeks ago as states continue to underestimate the number of people killed by the virus. This comes as some communities in California and other states are scaling back reopening plans after seeing a spike in COVID cases. The Supreme Court voted 5-4 Friday to uphold California's restrictions on church services during the pandemic. Meanwhile, the White House and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention removed coronavirus warnings about church choirs, even though they're believed to be so-called super spreaders of the infection. In other related news, President Trump has canceled a planned face-to-face summit of G7 leaders in June after German Chancellor Angela Merkel said a summit in Washington, D.C. would pose a major health risk. In Afghanistan, a journalist and a driver from a TV station were killed by a bomb blast in the capital, Kabul, Saturday. At least four others were injured. Officials say the private bus was directly targeted. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack. Afghanistan is one of the world's deadliest countries for journalists. Israeli police shot and killed an unarmed Palestinian man in occupied East Jerusalem Saturday. Iyad al-Halak was a 32-year-old special needs student who attended and worked at a school near where he was killed. Police say they thought he was carrying a weapon. Demonstrators took to the streets in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, with some protesters holding signs demanding justice for Iyad and for George Floyd. A day earlier Friday, Israeli soldiers killed a Palestinian man in the West Bank who they claimed tried to ram into them with his car. And four more women have accused convicted serial rapist and former Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein of sexual assault and rape in a new lawsuit filed in New York. One of the unnamed accusers was 17 at the time of the alleged attack. Weinstein is currently serving a 23-year sentence after being convicted of rape in February. He still faces criminal charges in Los Angeles. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. When we come back, we look at the nationwide uprising following the police killing of George Floyd, an African-American man in Minneapolis. We'll speak with Professors Cornel West and Kianga Yamata-Taylor, as well as attorney Bakari Sellers, his new book, My Vanishing Country. Stay with us.
Went down to the local coffee house. Sat there still holding my soy latte. I got everything in this world to live for. I pray to God you feel the same way. Too many lives lost for a broken cause. Shot down by division and fear. If we could only the wounds of yesterday, the future could be pretty clear. Yes, it could. What is life? Yeah, what is life? Yeah, yeah. What do we stand for today when we
Black Lives Matter by Andre Simone. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York City, joined by my co-host Nermeen Sheikh from her home, also here in New York City. Hi, Nermeen.
Good morning, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Well, in the largest nationwide uprising since the 1960s, protesters shut down cities across the United States over the weekend following the police killing of George Floyd, the 46-year-old African-American man in Minneapolis.
George Floyd! George Floyd! George Floyd! George Floyd!
George George Floyd died 1 week ago on Memorial Day when Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin arrested him and pressed his knee into Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes as Floyd repeatedly gasped, "I can't breathe," and then stopped moving. On Friday, Chauvin was charged with third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. The three other officers involved have been fired along with Chauvin, but not arrested. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz has announced Attorney General Keith Ellison will take the lead in the investigation and any prosecutions related to George Floyd's killing. At the Minneapolis intersection where Floyd was killed, people created a memorial and declared it a sacred space. Meanwhile, protests continued throughout the weekend from coast to coast. The police erupted in violence in response to the widespread protests, arresting more than 4,000 people and attacking demonstrators with tear gas and rubber bullets in cities across the country. Police cars and buildings went up in flames as thousands braved the coronavirus and increasing police violence to demonstrate. In New York City alone, authorities said 47 police vehicles have been damaged. At least 40 cities have imposed curfews. The National Guard's been deployed in Minnesota, California, Illinois, Florida, and other states. Police departments are facing increasing criticism for using excessive force on protesters and in at least 50 separate incidents attacking journalists. The protests come as the nation's dealing with its largest public health crisis in generations and the highest unemployment rate since the Great Depression. During protests Friday, President Trump was moved to the White House's underground bunker. On Saturday, he took to Twitter to threaten protesters with vicious dogs and ominous weapons. He also tweeted he would designate Antifa as a terrorist organization, even though legal experts say he lacks the authority to designate a domestic group as a terrorist organization and warned such a move would violate the First Amendment. Outrage over Floyd's death comes after protests led to the arrest of two white men last month for the February shooting death of black jogger Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia, and then a third man arrested. And after the Louisville police shooting death of Breonna Taylor in her home in March, which the FBI is now investigating. The demonstrations have been mostly outside with many people wearing masks, so it's unclear if they'll trigger spread of the coronavirus. But many protesters who were arrested were taken to jails that are COVID hotspots. For more, we're hosting a roundtable discussion with Dr. Cornel West, professor of the practice of public philosophy at Harvard University, author of many books, including Race Matters and Black Prophetic Fire. And we're joined by Kianga Yamada Taylor, assistant professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Her recent piece for The New York Times is headlined, "Of Course There Are Protests. The State is Failing Black People." She's also author of Race for Profit, How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermine Black Homeownership. And from Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. And with us from Charlotte, North Carolina, Bakari Sellers is with us, an attorney and author of his new memoir, My Vanishing Country. He became the youngest African-American elected official in the country when he was elected to the South Carolina State Legislature in 2006. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! We're going to begin with Professor Kianga Yamada Taylor. If you can respond to the mass uprising that has happened around the country and the police response to it, as well as the original horror on Memorial Day, the killing of George Floyd.
Well, thank you, Amy, for letting me come on this morning to talk. You know, I think part of what we are seeing is years and years of pent-up rage. Everyone, you know, many people have referenced the 1960s, have referenced Ferguson in 2014. But I think it's important to say that these are not just repeats of past events. These are the consequences of the failures of this government and the political establishment, the economic establishment of this country to resolve those crises. And so they build and accumulate over time. And we are watching the boiling over of that. Imagine how angry, desperate, rage-filled you would have to be to come out and protest in the conditions of a historical pandemic that has already killed over 103,000 Americans, that has had a disproportionately horrendous impact in Black communities. I believe 23 or 24,000 Black people have died. To put it more bluntly, one in every 2,000 African Americans in the United States has died as a result of COVID. So imagine how difficult things have to be for people to come out in those conditions. So I think that the buildup of, around police brutality, the continuation of police brutality, police abuse and violence and murder has compelled people to have to endure those conditions, because it is obvious that there is either nothing that our government can do about this, or that the government is complicit and chooses not to do anything about this. And I think that we have to add to that the crisis that is unfolding beyond police brutality in the country as well, because we all know that the videotapes of police beatings, abuse, murder have never stopped. So the movement that grew out of the Ferguson uprising that became Black Lives Matter, the conditions that led to that never actually ended. And I think that what has reignited that is obviously the public lynching of George Floyd 1 week ago in Minneapolis, but also the conditions, the wider context within which that is spilling over. And because of that wider condition of mass unemployment, of the death that has been caused by the pandemic, that this is not just, I don't believe these are just protests around or against police brutality. But we see a lot of hundreds, if not thousands, of young white people in these uprisings, making these multiracial rebellions, really. And I think that that is important. Some people have described the participation of white people as outside agitators, or I know that there are reports of white supremacists infiltrating some of the demonstrations. And I think that those are things that we have to pay attention to, keep track of, and try to understand. But I think we cannot dismiss in a widespread way the participation of young white people, because we have to see that what has happened over the last decade has gutted their lives too. And there has been some discussion about this with perhaps their parents' generation, with the description of deaths by despair. So we know that the life expectancy of ordinary white men and women has gone into reverse. Something, by the way, that does not typically happen in the developed world. And it is driven by opioid addiction, alcoholism, and suicide. And so this generation, whose lives really, you know, if you've graduated from college, your life has been bracketed by war at the turn of the 21st century, by recession, and now by a deadly pandemic. And so I think we're seeing the convergence of a class rebellion with racism and racial terrorism at the center of it. In many ways, we are in uncharted territory in the United States.
Dr. Cornel West, could you respond to what Professor Yamata Taylor said? You agree that, of course, the murder of George Floyd was a lynching. You've also said that his murder and the demonstrations that have followed show that America is a failed social experiment. So could you respond to that? And also the way that the state and police forces have responded to the protests following George Floyd's killing, with the National Guard called out in so many cities and states across the country?
Well, there's no doubt that this is America's moment of reckoning. But we want to make the connection between the local and the global. Because, you see, when you sow the seeds of greed domestically, inequality, globally, imperial tentacles, 800 military units abroad, violence in AFRICOM and Africa, supporting various regimes, dictatorial ones in Asia and so forth, there is a connection between the seeds that you sow of violence externally and internally. Same is true in terms of the seed of hatred or white supremacy, hating black people, anti-blackness hatred having its own dynamic within the context of a predatory capitalist civilization obsessed with money, 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 domination of workers, marginalization of those who don't fit, gay brothers, lesbian sisters, trans, and so forth. So it's precisely this convergence that my dear sister Professor Taylor is talking about of the ways in which the American empire imploding, its foundations being shaken with uprisings from below. The catalyst was certainly Brother George's Floyd public lynching, but the failures of the predatory capitalist economy to provide the satisfaction of the basic needs of food and health care and quality education, jobs with a decent wage. At the same time, the collapse of your political class, the collapse of your professional class, their legitimacy has been radically called into question, and that's multiracial. It's the neo-fascist dimension in Trump. It's the neoliberal dimension in Biden and Obama and the Clintons and so forth. And it includes much of the media. It includes many of the professors in universities. The young people are saying, you all have been hypocritical. You haven't been concerned about our suffering, our misery, and we no longer believe in your legitimacy. And it spills over into violent explosion. And it's here, I won't go on, but I mean, it's here where I think Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer and Rabbi Heschel and Edward Said, and especially Brother Martin and Malcolm, their legacies, I think, become more central because they provide the kind of truth-telling, they provide the connection between justice and compassion in their example, in their organizing, and that's what is needed right now. Rebellion is not the same thing in any way as revolution. And what we need is a nonviolent revolutionary project of full-scale democratic sharing, power, wealth, resources, respect, organizing, and the fundamental transformation of this American empire.
And your thoughts, Professor West, on the governor of Minnesota saying they're looking into white supremacist connections to the looting and the burning of the city, and then President Trump tweeting that he's going to try to put Antifa, the anti-fascist activists, on the terror list, which he cannot do. And William Barr emphasizing this, saying he's going after the far left to investigate.
No, what I mean, that's ridiculous. You know, you remember, Sister Amy, and I love and respect you so, that Antifa saved my life in Charlottesville. There's no doubt about it. That they provided the security, you see. So the very notion that they become candidates for a terrorist organization, but the people who are trying to kill us, the Nazis, the Klan, they're not candidates for a terrorist organization status. But that's what you're going to get. You're going to get a Trump-led neo-fascist backlash and clampdown on what is going on. We ought to be very clear about that. That neo-fascism has that kind of obsession with militaristic imposition in the face of any kind of disorder. And so we got to be fortified for that. But most importantly, I think we've got to make sure that we preserve our own moral, spiritual quality, our fundamental focus on truth and justice, and keep track of legalized looting, Wall Street greed, legalized murder, police, legalized murder abroad in Yemen, in Pakistan, in Africa, with AFRICOM and so forth. That's where our focus has to be, because with all of this rebellious energy, it's got to be channeled through organizations rooted in a quest for truth and justice.
I want to bring Bakari Sellers into the conversation. In 2006, he became the youngest African-American statewide elected official in the country when he was elected to the South Carolina State Legislature. Well, he has his memoir out. It's called My Vanishing Country. And one of the central moments in the book is the Orangeburg Massacre of 1968, one of the most violent, least remembered events of the civil rights movement. A crowd of students gathered on the campus of South Carolina State University to protest segregation at Orangeburg's only bowling alley. Dozens of police arrived on the scene, state troopers. They fired live ammunition into the crowd. When the shooting stopped, three black students were dead, 28 students wounded. Nine officers who opened fire were all acquitted. But there was one person who went to jail. It was Bakari Sellers' father, Cleveland Sellers, a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, known as SNCC, convicted of a riot charge and actually sent 7 months behind bars. He was pardoned decades later. Bakari Sellers, it's an honor to have you with us. You say that February 8th was the most important day of your life, but you weren't even born yet. Talk about the connections to what was happening then to what's happening today in this country.
First, thank you for having me on such an august and esteemed panel here this morning. February 8, 1968 is by far the most important day of my life. Not only did law enforcement shoot into a crowd, killing Henry Smith and Samuel Hammond and Delano Middleton, not only did they shoot my father, not only was he the only person who was incarcerated, but there's been trauma that's lingered since then. My sister was born while my father was still locked away. The first time that my father was able to see my sister was actually on the prison yard. But when I think about George Floyd, where we are today, and I think about Ahmaud Arbery, and I think about Breonna Taylor, it just goes back even further. You know, my father got started in the movement, and I think Dr. West will acknowledge that the names that he mentioned, the Ella Bakers, the Fannie Lou Hamers, they were all a part of what we call the Emmett Till generation in 1955, when that picture was in Ebony magazine, and the whole world was able to see that image of what racism and bigotry and hate had done to young Emmett Till. But you think about Emmett, you think about Jimmie Lee Jackson, you think about Medgar Evers, you think about not just the Orangeburg Massacre, but the four little girls in Birmingham, and the list goes on and on and on. And my father is 75 years old today. I'm 35 years old. And the biggest problem we have in this country is that we have many of the same shared experiences. In My Vanishing Country, I not only talk about Orangeburg and, you know, some of the successes I've had, but I've also talked about the fact that I've had to bury good friends, one of which was Clemente Pinckney, who was the pastor of Mother Emmanuel AMB Church, who was killed after Bible study with eight others just because of the color of his skin. That's the country that we live in. And what you're seeing today is not just about George Floyd. I don't want anybody to think that. What we're seeing today is about systemic injustice and systemic racism that's plagued this country for 400 years. And just to harp on Brother West's point for a second, just to drive it home, and one of the things I highlight in My Vanishing Country, I'm from Denmark, South Carolina, where we have three stoplights and a blinking light. And I grew up in a food desert, meaning that you couldn't go 2 to 3 miles and get fresh fruits and vegetables, meaning that you probably have a higher propensity to have things like diabetes. We're drinking dirty water where I'm from, which means that you are taking in toxins that are likely to cause cancer at higher rates. Inhaling dirty air because of brownfields in the manufacturing plants, meaning that you're more likely to have asthma. Because we didn't expand Medicaid, my hospital shut down. We live along what's called the corridor of shame, in which kids go to school and their heating and air don't work and their infrastructure is falling apart. These are the systemic injustices and systemic racism that we're highlighting and talking about. And then you overlay that with the pandemic. And it's no question that my father says it all the time. When America gets a cold, black folk get the flu. Well, now America has COVID and black folk are dying. And then you think about the bodies, this black, violent, killing porn that we are obsessed with in this country. We have George Floyd, who was killed like a dog. Let me not even say like a dog, because if he was a dog, they actually would have arrested all four officers by now. But there was a knee to the back of his neck for 8 to 9 minutes. And I think that there is so many people, including myself, who are questioning, as the parents of black children in this country, how do we go about raising them? What do we tell them? These are questions of and a crisis of conscience that is now facing the United States of America. And so I hope people, if they pick up My Vanishing Country, black folk get a sense of pride. But I hope white folk get a sense of understanding. Because before you can get to atonement, and black folk are always in a position in this country of forgiving, but before we can even get to that point, we have to have understanding. We have to have empathy. And the last thing I'll tell you, Amy, is from Orangeburg to Charleston, all the way back to Emmett to now George, the common linchpin is this, that people of color in this country and around the world are not giving the benefit of their humanity. You cannot tell me that those officers saw George Floyd as being human. They saw him as something less than. And so until we start fundamentally giving black folk the benefit of their humanity, we will still have these systemic problems that are now boiled over into the streets. Do not tell my people to go home. Do not ask for peace until you are also asking for justice. Justice has to become a verb in this country, not just a noun.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. That's Bakari Sellers, former state legislator in South Carolina, now author of his memoir. It's called My Vanishing Country, released during the pandemic. Dr. Cornel West is with us from Harvard University and Kianga Yamata Taylor of Princeton University, speaking to us from Philadelphia, one of the cities where people rose up over the last week. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back with all in a minute.
Have you ever worn the mask? Yeah. 1 2 1 2.
M to the A to the S to the K. Put the mask on the face just to make it next day. Feds be hawking me. Jokers be stalking me. I walk the street and camouflage my identity.
My posse in the Brooklyn wear the mask. My crew in the Jersey wear the mask. Pick up kids doing boogie woogie wear the mask.
Yeah, everybody wear the mask. Yo,
yo, I used to work at Burger King. A king taking orders. Punching my clock, now I'm wanted by the manager. Souping me up, saying,
you're a good worker. How would you like a quarter raise? Move up to the register. Large in charge, but you gotta be a spy. Come back and tell me who's bagging my fries. Getting high on company time.
Hell no, sirree. Wrong MC. Why should I be a spy when you're spying me? And you see what you thought you saw but never seen. You missed the last move. Checkmate, crown me king.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're continuing with our guests. We're joined by Kianga Yamata Taylor, professor at Princeton University, Dr. Cornel West at Harvard University, and Bakari Sellers joining us from North Carolina. His new book is just out, My Vanishing Country. I'm here with Nermeen Sheikh as we continue to bring you the voices of the rebellion around the country in the largest nationwide uprising since the 60s. Protesters shut down cities across the country following the police murder of George Floyd, the African-American man in Minneapolis. This is activist, former Women's March co-chair Tamika Mallory, speaking at a rally in Minneapolis.
We are not responsible for the mental illness that has been inflicted upon our people by the American government, institutions, and those people who are in positions of power. I don't give a damn if they burn down Target, because Target should be on the streets with us calling for the justice that our people deserve.
Talk about it, Tamika.
Where was AutoZone at the time when Philando Castile was shot in a car, which is what they actually represent? Where were they? So if you are not coming to the people's defense,
right,
then don't challenge us when young people and other people who are frustrated and instigated by the people you pay. You are paying instigators to be among our people out there throwing rocks, breaking windows, and burning down buildings. And so young people are responding to that. They are enraged. And there's an easy way to stop it. Arrest the cops. Charge the cops. Charge all the cops. Not just some of them. Not just here in Minneapolis. Charge them in every city across America where our people are being murdered. Charge them everywhere. That's the bottom line. Charge the cops. Do your job. Do what you say this country is supposed to be about, the land of the free for all. It has not been free for black people, and we are tired. Don't talk to us about looting. Y'all are the looters. America has looted black people. America looted the Native Americans when they first came here. So looting is what you do. We learned it from you. We learned violence from you. We learned violence from you. The violence was what we learned from you. So if you want us to do better, then damn it, you do better.
Activist Tamika Mallory speaking in Minneapolis over the weekend. Professor Kianga Yamata-Taylor, if you could respond to her extraordinary speech, and also the way in which public officials, including liberal officials like New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, have responded to the protests, simultaneously saying they feel the pain of the protesters, but condemning the violence and looting, as they say, that have happened during the demonstrations. And then the fact that there are many who've been calling for defunding the police in response to what's happened here. I mean, one of the things that's been so remarkable about the images everywhere are the kind of military gear that so many of these police officers are wearing. I mean, one Democratic senator, Brian Schatz from Hawaii, tweeted Sunday in response saying that he's introducing an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act to discontinue the program that transfers military weaponry to local police departments. Professor Kianga Yamata-Taylor, if you could respond.
Yeah, there's so many things to say about this. I think one thing that becomes so apparent with the cops on the street, one, you understand, I mean, for most of America, you get a glimpse of why people are so angry. I mean, look at the kind of wanton, reckless abuse and violence that the police are instigating and attacking people who are trying to protest. I feel like what we've seen over the weekend is a national police riot. And, you know, it's no wonder they feel emboldened by the white nationalism of the president of the United States and really the lawlessness of the Republican Party writ large. And so it feels like we're bearing the consequences of that. But I think that there is a bigger issue about the cops that is also worth talking about, which is why these police are never arrested, prosecuted, punished, really, even beyond just, you know, arresting and prosecuting people, but just punishing them as public servants for their kind of racist, abusive and violent behavior. And I think that, you know, regardless of what these elected officials have to say, I think that we're actually going to see a lot more of this, which is why the conflicts will continue. And the reason why I say that is because it has been a strategy of cities across this country that have committed themselves to not investing in the civic and public sector infrastructure. So public schools, public hospitals, public libraries, all of the things that make a city function. Those have been systematically defunded, increasingly privatized. And the way that cities manage the inevitable crises that arise from that, when combined with unemployment, when combined with poverty, when combined with evictions and all of the insecurities that we see racking cities across this country, the police are used to manage that crisis. And that is why in city after city, as other public institutions take financial hits, as other public institutions are defunded, it's the police that always get to maintain their budgets. And we look around now where, because of the COVID crisis, every city is talking about massive budget cuts, but not to the police. The police almost never have to incur layoffs. They never have to incur budget cuts because they are seen as the public policy of last resort. And so this is, when we talk about defunding the police, it is that the police should not be absorbing a third of the budget, as they do in cities like Philadelphia, Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, while we're closing public schools, while public hospitals don't have the proper personal protective equipment. Look at the way that police are the gear and the equipment that they have compared to hospital workers dressing themselves in garbage bags, being forced to use the same N95 masks for weeks at a time. Look at the contrast between that, and then you understand what the actual priorities of the governing politicians and bodies are, which is why, and this is the last thing I'll say, the hypocrisy of someone like Andrew Cuomo or Bill de Blasio or any of these politicians coming on television, on their the press conference, wringing their hands about the police, talking about these issues as if they are passive bystanders or just concerned citizens and not elected officials who have power, who have authority, who have the ability to punish the police, who have the ability to make budgetary priorities, who have the ability to shift resources in one direction or another. But they sit back and act as if they are just watching the train wreck in slow motion and not that they are actually in control of the gears. And this is part of the hypocrisy that is making people so angry, is that we have these elected officials getting on television talking about how terrible this is. Andrew Cuomo saying, say her name. Andrew Cuomo, do your job. And I think that this is part of what is forcing people to feel that they have no other choice, no other response than to rebel, because the levers and mechanisms of government that are supposed to attend to these issues have shown themselves to be completely broken.
Professor Cornel West, if you could comment on what Professor Kianga Yamata-Taylor said, and also the fact that some observers are saying that all of these emergencies occurring simultaneously, the economic emergency with over 40 million Americans now unemployed, the health crisis with the pandemic, that these could result, and then, of course, these protests across the country, that these could result in some significant structural transformation within the U.S., as occurred in part following the Great Depression and the protests of 68. Do you agree with that? And if so, what kind of transformation do you think is essential?
Well, I would just want to say first, just ditto to what Sister Taylor said. And I want to say, of course, send my salute to Brother Bakari. He's part of a family of political royalty with Brother Cleveland and others in so many ways. But I think we also have to be very candid about the decadent leadership class. That when Sister Taylor talks about Cuomo and the others, absolutely. But you see, we've had a black leadership that has so sanitized and deodorized the black freedom struggle that you end up with neoliberal politicians who have accommodated themselves to the Wall Street greed. That's why they bail out Wall Street rather than everyday people. They've accommodated themselves to the killing machine of the Pentagon and State Department. That's why they can vote for budgets where 53% of every cent goes to the military, and there's no money left for investment in education, healthcare, jobs with a living wage. And we haven't had enough organized voices to bring critique to bear on that kind of decrepit neoliberal black leadership. And Obama's at the center of it. The black caucus is at the center of it. Black professionals are at the center of it. And these cowardly black celebrities, not all of them, but most of them, are at the center of it. So their lives become simply lives of luxury and exemplary of success, and have little to do with service to poor people, have little to do with sacrificing for working people. So when Martin King can say, my country is the biggest purveyor of violence in the world, that takes courage. In 68, takes courage today. That's the kind of courage we need. Malcolm would be the same way. Fannie Lou, Ella Baker, these are not just names. They exemplify something that's deep and rich in the history of a hated people who've taught the world so much about love. That's my tradition, the greatness of black people, not the cowardliness of black people. We got both in our community, but to our tradition of telling the truth and being willing to live and die for justice, that is what is necessary in this moment of reckoning. And we don't, young folk hardly see it at all. Hardly see it at all. Because so many of the professionals have simply been bought off. They sold out. They're indifferent. They're too callous to the plight of their poor and working class. Not just black, everybody. Not just here, but around the world. The wretched of the earth that the great Frantz Fanon wrote about with such power.
Bakari Sellers, I want to ask you about the accusation that when they look at a state, who are the outside agitators who are coming in? You certainly know from your family's illustrious history that when people came from the North to support the push for voting in the South during the civil rights movement, that to go from one state to another, to for groups of people all over the country, for example, to go to Ferguson after Michael Brown was murdered by a police officer, that meant solidarity. It didn't mean that it took away their validity when people want to gather to show support. If you could respond to that, this accusation of outside agitators. And then, as an attorney, why aren't these police officers, why haven't they been arrested? Felonise Floyd, George's brother, said, these cops arrest people every single day. Why are these police officers not charged right now? They can even change the charges later.
So you brought up a good point, and nothing makes me cringe more than hearing the term outside agitator. What it is a cop-out, elected officials, and we're seeing that used to say that my own constituents don't have any reason to have this level of discord. They deemed my father to be an outside agitator. They said that Andrew Goodman and Mickey Schwerner and James Cheney were outside agitators. So that terminology, it just frightens me to my core. But it's also a cop-out, and I want to piggyback on what my other two friends on this program stated, that right now is not the time to just tell people to go home. Now is not the time to hide behind sheets of peace. And now is not the time to tell people just to go home and wait until November when you can cast your ballot. That's just not the way this is working. We have to have tangible solutions, which leads me into the next point. I've heard a lot of elected officials, including to Dr. West's point, black elected officials stand up and say, leave the streets, go home and just register and vote. Well, in 64, 65, 68, imagine telling Ella Baker or Fannie Lou Hamer or my father, Cleveland Sellers, or Martin or Malcolm, that they had to just go home and come back when it was time to vote. That's not the way this works. You asked a very good question about what needs to happen and why law enforcement hasn't been charged. And let me give you some very tangible things that we can do that need to be done. The first thing to my sister, Tamika Mallory, who I'm glad I didn't have to go after her because I don't have anything to say after she speaks. I would oftentimes say that the first thing we need to do is arrest all the officers. All the officers need to be arrested, not just in George Floyd's case, but they also need to be arrested in Breonna Taylor's case. The second thing we need to do is we need to lower the federal civil rights standard so that we can bring criminal charges against cops who murder our people. The third thing we need to do is limit qualified immunity so we can bring these 1983 actions against cops who were bad and departments who allow them to be bad. And the fourth thing we need to do is we need to have a national database for law enforcement officers who commit bad acts. Right now, you can murder somebody, get off, go two cities down and get rehired. That is not the way this should be. And those are tangible solutions that I don't want to wait till November for. I want people to put pressure on their local officials and government right now to do those things. And every mayor, every governor.
We have to leave it there. But we are certainly going to continue the discussion. Bakari Sellers, attorney, author of the new book, his memoir, My Vanishing Country. Dr. Cornel West, professor in practice of public philosophy at Harvard University. And Kianga Yamata Taylor of Princeton. I'm Amy Goodwin, Norman Shea.